not because I think I'm really competent to do it, but because it's been a topic of interest, and I think it's important to work on trying to understand. I've been rereading, as I was saying, this like last talk on kindness, clarity, insight, and I thought like first I like would go through that. Let's try to go through that a little bit. I'm just picking out some parts and saying what I think I mean and that what it means, what this holiness meant, and then what I take to be the gist of it. In terms of how it relates to the question that we had this morning about, the question was about what would Tsongkhapa would say, and we answered that, but then we had the problem of, well, what would His Holiness say about different, many different kinds of Tibetan Buddhism where people are practicing in different ways, which seem to be saying very many different things, and yet he's the Dalai Lama who's revered by all of them. So, anyway.
One quick question. Was this in the original edition or was it added in the original?
I think it's in the original. And the original was published in 1984. I'm having a little difficulty remembering the exact year of this talk, but I think it's something like 1981, but I don't know exactly. It's called The Union of the Old and New Translation Schools. And he gave this talk in Jeffrey's basement. And Jeffrey invited, all his grad students, which included me, and then other friends, and so we had, the basement was quite full, and he had an altar set up there, and His Holiness came, and then he started to just give this talk, and it was like someone was hitting us with something, because it was like every other sentence was like something that we didn't understand. It was just, what is he saying? What is he saying? And it was like, it wasn't, how sometimes he goes back and forth, but this wasn't like that. That was like, okay, now I'm going to tell you what I really think. And, and if you don't, I felt like, well, if we don't understand, we'll just sit here and, hear these words that we don't understand, and maybe we'll get some. And it's like, so I read it a bunch of times, and then I've just read it a few times this week. To really understand it, you have to have read all these books that he's read, and he studied with Nyingma teachers, clearly, not just read the books. It's not like you can really. But anyway, I think it's still worth trying to get something out of what he was saying. So he starts by saying, "This is a personal account." Which is, interesting. This is like, he's going to not give his general, tarmac talk about how everybody wants happiness and doesn't want suffering. This is like, he's going to say, well, this is what I've really been working on and trying to figure out. And it turns out to be about, in some way, how conventional truth and ultimate truth might relate to each other and enlightenment, but taking into consideration both sutra and tantra and as presented in all four orders of Tibetan Buddhism. I don't know if you guys read the beginning of my Two Truths book, the big white one, but when I had a short audience with His Holiness in 1985 when I was working on that book, where I just asked him strictly philosophical questions. And during that time he said, well, what you really should do is do a book on the two truths in the four systems in Tibet as presented in Sutra and Tantra. And I was like, well, I haven't gotten to that yet. But in the meantime, he was already hard at work on it. And he's like, has made some progress. So what is his first thing? For a long time, I've had a one-pointed belief that Nyingma, Sakya, Gagyu, and Gelug are all unions of Sutra and Mantra, as well as all being of the Prasangika school in terms of their view of emptiness. So Bhagavan says, like, this sets up a lot of what's going to happen later, is that he's not going to be saying, well, Nyingma really doesn't have the Prasangika view, but that's okay because somehow they have something else that does the trick. Right? He's going to say that, you know, that in terms of the view of emptiness, His Holiness is going to say that there's something that works as an equivalent of that, a homologue of that, to eradicate the root of sickly existence in all the different systems. Okay, so I'm skipping a great deal, of course, and then he starts with Kagyupa, and he talks about how Milarepa, in one of the songs that he identifies, says that there advocates for a non-confusion of dependent arisings within the sphere of conventional truth, as well as the non-findability of emptiness, even emptiness, ultimately. So that's what he's looking for in a view, is saying that at the conventional level, you know the difference between apples and pears, right and wrong, you know, cars and potatoes and so forth. And that at the ultimate level, this whatever you're positing as the highest or absolute or, you know, most irreducible thing is itself empty. And he finds that to be the case in Milarepa, at least. Although, of course, Milarepa has different songs, and some of them have different thrust than that, I would say. But anyway, in one song called The Song to the Five Long Life Sisters, he finds a passage that suggests that. Okay, so then he comes to Sakya, which he gives the shortest amount of attention, because Tsongkhapa studied with all different kinds of teachers, of course. He couldn't go to a Gelugpa teacher. What was with that? So he studied with all different kinds of teachers, and one of his main teachers, of course, was Rendawa, who was the Sakya, and, you know, some of Tsongkhapa's works, some of his early works were written when he was still, you know, writing from sort of the Rendawa influence point of view. And so he just simply gives the shortest shrift of this. He thinks it's almost obvious to anybody that Sakya and Gelugpa are talking about the same thing with different words. Not everybody has agreed with that, but anyway, it's not like the thrust of his concern here. He thinks that these things are clearly very close. So therefore, he's saying, well, these three orders, you know, the later translation schools that close. He finds relatively easy to see that there's a convergence in the way they look at things. On the other hand, he says that the roots of that Nyingma, on the other hand, it is much more difficult to see the similarity in terms of what their view is and how they might be, you know, have a realizing emptiness as we understand it in Gelugpa. Okay, so that's acknowledging that's why there's a problem. That's the whole point of this, is to try to look at that problem and see how his one point of view, that they all have the same prasangika view in some sense about emptiness, could be reconciled with difficulty in the case of Nyingma. So the first thing then he says is that Tsongkhapa had a Nyingma master, Namkha Gyaltsen, and praised his teaching. And not only that, which of course that wouldn't, he could have studied anything with him, but then, in particular, he says, Tsongkhapa generated great ascertainment concerning the view through his reliance upon his Nyingma master, Namkha Gyaltsen. So, I mean, he's bringing out a point that probably wouldn't be highlighted in some other biographies, but that you can find, you know, that this is, that one of the emptiness teachers for the founder of Gelugpa was a Nyingma. Right, and there's many points like this in here where he's just trying to get people to think twice. Then he makes a point that was sort of alluded to earlier, that prior to any of the other three orders that existing in Tibet, there were many adepts, people who were it reached high levels of enlightenment, and in those lifetimes had only it was in that in those very lifetimes. So leaving a little wiggle room there. Might have had some predispositions from past lifetimes. But in those very lifetimes, they depended only on the Nyingma path. Right? And yet were able to reach high states of attainment. And then he goes on to say, then after the new translation school, Chirluk arise, then there's still, in other words, in effect, down to today, we see attained Nyingma masters who were practicing Nyingma practices, and somehow seem to be, doing that without relying upon Tsongkhapa. Then there's a long bit from Kedrup, who has that says quite a lot about why it's bad to be deprecatory toward the great perfection Dzogchen practice of Nyingma, and answers questions about, well, if it's so great, why does everybody say it's so bad? And he said, well, there's some practitioners who, you know, misguidedly interpreting the doctrines have engaged in behavior that's brought disrepute on the old translation practice. And of course, that's exactly the kind of thing that I was alluding to earlier, that's the basis of some, you know, Tsongkhapa's concern, both in saying, you know, in the Great Treatise on the Stage of the Path, that you have to have a way to talk about emptiness that allows for valid establishment of ethical practices, ethical distinctions. And then also, and we didn't talk about in his great exposition of secret mantras, saying that, you know, the core of mantra involves, you know, keeping your vows and then practicing deity yoga, and it doesn't involve that's not like the common core of yoga to be engaging in, what we say, like antinomian practice, a tantra to be engaging in antinomian practices or something like that. But in any case, well, it's not that you just come from Gelugpa sources that there was some problem. You can look at other sources, historical sources that were independent and contemporary, that there was some problem, and that other people had, other lamas, you know, before Tsongkhapa had tried to do something to reform Tibetan Buddhism and get monasticism well established and the situation cleaned up and a clarity of understanding. And of course, that's part of what, you know, Atisha was, his lineage was like trying to do, and that the Gelugpa see themselves as a continuation. But they weren't the only ones who were trying to do that. Some of the texts that I've read have said, like, well, that sometimes there was so much animal sacrifice going on that the goats were just running away. You know, this is like all Buddhists, right? So who's like, what are these rites that are requiring to do this, all this animal sacrifice? And that there was all kinds of sexual practices that led to questions about the integrity of the Sangha. And also then, you know, situations where gurus in the name of, you know, higher tantric understanding would give people instructions that would, like we were alluding to this morning, you know, seem to go against basic principles of integrity and so forth. There is actually like one that sticks in my mind where, you know, a teacher was saying, well, you need to go and, you know, marry as many women as you can to collect dowry so you can give it to me as an offering, you know, before I'll give you initiation. Okay, so that kind of stuff was like, not, yes.
But are you saying that this kind of corrupt behavior is a direct result of a relationship to the
philosophy? No, I wasn't saying that. I let's see. I think this is like, I'm trying to suggest that there might be an indirect relationship in the following way, that I think that one of the reasons the Gelugpa order was so successful was because Tsongkhapa created a philosophical foundation that allowed a grounding of ethical distinctions that led to the flourishing of a monastic order that probably had something to do with the condition for the growing political power of the order. So I see all those things as kind of like what? That they're all related. It's not just like one absolutely determines the other. But if you have a philosophy that says, look, there are conventional valid distinctions, then you can have, you know, you can say to people, well, you know, it would be really helpful if you would take vows and actually keep them and not just think that because you're a tantra that's like something lower. Okay? And then, our philosophy of emptiness doesn't, neither our philosophy of emptiness nor our philosophy of tantra cancels out your ethical commitments to keep these vows. And that's what Tsongkhapa's system did. So I guess what I'm saying is that the lack of such a clear system about how to understand tantra or to understand emptiness in a way that didn't undermine ethical distinctions was a problem. It wasn't that, like, because that no one understood the right view, or that everybody was misbehaving. It's just that you didn't have an articulated teaching that provided a foundation for that kind of, you know, systematic ethical practice. So there were all the, and then K Group says, well, you shouldn't, even just because there were a few bad apples in effect, it's still very bad to deprecate Nyingma or Dzogchen in general. And then because this is K Group, and you know, the close follower of Tsongkhapa, and because he talks about this at length, then His Holiness quotes it at great length. To show that this is not something that he's making up, but that K Group himself was defending, saying that derision of Nyingma is just a kind of let's say over extrapolation from the bad behavior of certain individuals, and shouldn't be done, because it's like deprecating the great perfection doctrine itself and practice itself, which is legitimate. That's basically what K Group's saying. So now, he started by saying, I think that these four Sherluk add up to the same thing in terms of the view of emptiness. Now he comes to say, I'm not the first person to say that. Many in each of the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, even, you know, he's just counting four here, the four that we mentioned, have said that all have the same basic thought. And then he cites his number one Gelugpa. He doesn't go through and cite all people from all the different orders who say that. But he cites his number one Gelugpa person who says that, who is the great Losang Chirgi Gyaltsen, who is usually counted as the first Panchen Lama. And this seems definitely to have been the first Panchen Lama's view. And he then quotes that passage where he lists, he says, well, there's all different kinds of names, there's all kinds of different systems, exorcism, great perfection, equal taste, fivefold, small case, innate union, pacification, great perfection. And when these are analyzed by an experienced yogi who's skilled in both scripture and reasoning, they come down to the same thought. That's what the Panchen Lama said. So, you know, His Holiness makes it clear a little bit later that he absolutely thinks the first Panchen Lama really meant that he wasn't kidding around, and that it's right. But other Gelugpas have forcefully articulated different points of view. Including the third Panchen Lama, who one would presume would have the first same view as the first Panchen Lama. But the third Panchen Lama came out and said, well, you know, the first Panchen Lama said that, but that was what he had to say because he was under political pressure to say something that would, you know, help the different Chirlu come together at that point in time. And he had a political intention behind his words, and he didn't really mean that in terms of a philosophical claim. And the reason, and then Third Panchen Lama goes on to say, the reason that that's the case, the reason it couldn't really be the same, and this we come to the non-affirming negative, is because the great perfection realizes an affirming negative as their ultimate, whereas the Gelugpa realizes, and I don't know why I'm laughing, it's like such a, well, because it just sounds like such a, when you just say it like that, it sounds like, okay, that seems like a strange thing to fight about. But no, it really was a very, very, very big deal, okay? The idea that emptiness is a mere absence, a sheer lack of intrinsic nature. And that's what we were talking about before in terms of, like, what do we mean when we say dependent arising and emptiness are the same, or what do we mean when we say form is emptiness is form? We can't literally mean that the nature of form, that form itself is exactly in every way identical to emptiness, because then when we looked at forms, we would be all enlightened. We perceive them directly, and we're not all enlightened. So it has to be understood that these two things have the same import, that they're like the duck rabbit, that they're right there together, that there isn't anything extra that's separate, but that it's not that the duck is the rabbit. It's like, knowing one doesn't mean that you know the other, even directly perceiving one doesn't mean you directly perceive the other, even though they're right there together and there's no separating them. Okay, so as we're going to see, the idea is only the great perfection, according to the, you know, there's this question about, like, when you come to what they're describing as this sort of culminating realization, there's like a mind that's at the core of it. Emptiness mind together, and not just emptiness, to put it simply. Okay, and so that's like there's something. There's mind, empty, pure mind. Okay, so that's not at all what the Gyalupas want to hear in an idea of what somebody should be realizing in order to become free from cyclic existence. And His Holiness makes a point that, you know, like, because of this, there have been, unfortunately, a number of Gyalupas who have been deprecating the great perfection as a whole as a result of this difference about what kind of an absence or lack emptiness is. And he calls this a very sad state of affairs. Okay, so... then he goes on to say that what he's going to tell you what he thinks about this, but that it's not all his original idea. So he got the core of his idea from a Nyingma master who died in 1926, named Dodrochen Jikme Denbe Nyima. Okay, so this guy had spent a lot of time studying all different Chirluk. I'm presuming this was like coming out of the Rinne tradition, but then adding in, you know, studying the Gyalupa ideas as well. And he wrote, you know, in a way that His Holiness just finds to be the most perceptive about trying to sort out these differences. The first thing that then His Holiness, as influenced by this Nyingma writer, deriving from this Nyingma writer, says is that you can't just take Nagarjuna and put Nagarjuna or Chandrakirti here, and then put Dzogchen text here, and say, "Gosh, they seem really different," because it's not apples and oranges. He doesn't say exactly like that, but that you have to, because you're talking about a shastra that's based on a sutra, is not part of the tantric tradition, doesn't involve any of the tantric practice, and you're comparing it to a tantric practice on the Nyingma side. That's actually their highest level of many of different levels of tantric practice. So it's just not suitable. So he said, what you have to do is sort of look at what in the new translation schools, and of course he's especially interested in Gyalupa practice, is done in terms of the Guhya Samaja tantra practice. And say when we do Guhya Samaja tantra practice, it's not like we're realizing some different emptiness from the one that Nagarjuna taught and Chandrakirti explained, but we're realizing emptiness with a special kind of mind, not the ordinary kind of mind. Okay, so it's like even within Gyalupa, it's not at the highest level of tantra. He's saying even within our system, when you're finally realizing emptiness with the subtlest and deepest kind of mind, it's not this coarse, dualistic, discursive, analytical mind at all. It's an extremely subtle mind, right? Which here he calls the innate wisdom of great bliss. But then as we go along through the text, you'll see he'll be talking about this also in terms of the clear light. So there's this very subtle mind, that is discussed in all the highest yoga tantra texts, I guess, and that is like not something that's it's not. There are different ideas about this between different tantras and between the different orders, but it's not like there's some one of these true that doesn't have some idea of some very subtle mind that's involved in the process of becoming enlightened. It's like, for example, if you come to the end of the great treatise and he's gone through all this logic and all these things about bodhicitta and all these things about ethics and so forth, and you've gone on to the end of the third volume, what do you come to at the very end? He says, well, having done all that for a warm-up, now you definitely must enter into the tantric path. And so then we'll be getting on to, eventually getting this subtle mind that you need to really realize emptiness, whereby you can become a Buddha. Okay. So this is what he's saying, is that you can't compare what we're talking about directly to great perfection, and then it's not fair. In other words, of course it's going to look really different. And he's basically saying, and that's what these geishas are doing. Okay, so he's not going to do that. He still might have some problems, but anyway, that's what he set out. Then one of the things that's very complicated here, and which I'm going to not go into too much, is that in these tantric systems, they talk about the two truths, but they all are, the meaning of the two truths is always different. It's like every tantric text has, it's not like when they say ultimate truth, they're not just meaning, okay, emptiness. They might have emptiness, they might believe that everything is empty of intrinsic nature, but then they might call ultimate truth some like kind of mind, you know, subtle mind that's realizing it, instead of calling it that emptiness itself the ultimate truth. And that's true in you know, tantric systems within Gelugpa. It's not just like, it's so the words. So one of the things that you find when you read this is that, relating to the question we had earlier about different tenet systems, is that you have to get you have to get not totally attached to a certain kind of vocabulary and saying these words establish the truth, and if someone doesn't use them in the right order, they must not understand things. There's different ways, of course, to do that. You could read Theravada stuff and find out that they really seem to realize emptiness. Or you can read, you know, Chan Master Sheng Yan and find out that, contrary to expectations, he really believes that there's content to Chan insight, and that, you know, and when he went on retreat, he spent a lot of time reading books. and so you can and say, it's like, oh, well, even though they're using different kinds of language, we can't just assume that, you know, they don't get it. We have to look closely and see what their real assertion is, because they're going to use different language. Everybody, all these different systems use different language. So His Holiness seems to be, in this, I just think, phenomenally nimble at not stumbling over the fact that suddenly Chirni, you know, which means like dharmata or the nature of reality, suddenly refers to a consciousness. And instead of just saying, oh, that must be wrong, he's going like, well, what are they really saying? He constantly is making these kinds of moves through here. And he gives, and then just to show that it's not just other people who use language in different kinds of ways, he will cite, you know, Gelugpa sources and say, well, this person says that such and such is uncompounded, you know, or not put together out of parts, but he doesn't really mean that, even though he went to the dialectic school, he has a special meaning. So people have different, you know, there's different ways of using language, right? And, okay, so having done all that, what does he say? In the highest yoga tantra system of the new translation schools, the fundamental mind that serves as the basis for all phenomena of cyclic existence and nirvana, to be called the ultimate truth or the nature of phenomena, but usually we call it the mind of clear light. And in Nyingma, they have the same thing, he doesn't say the same thing, but he says, in Nyingma, it, I circled this word, I was like, it, what's the reference of it? It is everything he just said about our mind. Our mind of clear light is now it, and it's going to be the subject, and the predicate is going to be something called mind vajra, which is, you know, the Nyingma idea. So in Nyingma, it, he's saying, well, this thing is like a fundamental mind that's the basis for, you know, the appearances of cyclic existence in nirvana, is mind of clear light. This is called mind vajra in Nyingma. Okay? And it's also called basic knowledge, or rikpa. It's not, because they have a different word, mind, which is different from basic knowledge, rikpa. But so mind vajra is like rikpa. And he says, this is the factor of mere luminosity and knowing, basic knowledge itself. And this is the final root of all minds. It is forever indestructible. It is immutable. It has an unbreakable continuum that is like a vajra. That's why it's called the vajra mind. Okay. And so, you know, getting warmed up to not like that. And he says, well, the new translation school is also positive, beginningless, endless, fundamental mind. And Justin is a mind of clear light. And in the same way, the Nyingma posits a mind vajra that has no beginning and no end and proceeds without interruption or continuing through the final state, you know, complete enlightenment as a Buddha. Right. So in Nyingma, this mind vajra is not posited as the ultimate because it's the object found by a consciousness that distinguishes emptiness. It's none of the reasons he's saying it's not. They call it the ultimate, but it's not the ultimate because in the same way that, like, when you search to say what things ultimately are. I mean, he said the word ultimate is used in a lot of ways. You know, the ultimate attainment on the path and so forth. And he's saying, well, it's like, when they say it's the ultimate, they're not meaning that when you search for the mode of abiding of things in the analytical way that you come down to that in the same way. Rather, it's the fundamental mind of clear light that has no beginning and end and is the basis for things appearing in cyclic existence in nirvana. It has the nature of being the truth body. So that's like what we were talking about the other day, that sort of we have this sort of fundamental truth body at the level of our fundamental mind. Beyond all adventitious phenomena, you know, things that just come and go based on karma, it's an ultimate truth, and all conventional truths, all the coarse forms and so forth that we appear, are its manifestations or its sport, right? And so then they use that word quite a lot. It's like that there's this fundamental mind, and then it plays at causing all these different kinds of appearances to arise and all the appearances of cyclic existence. So the nature, you could say, or the entity, the character of this basic mind is that it is essentially pure. I said, all right, now we've got you. it's essentially pure. And then His Holiness finishes the sentence, which means, in the vocabulary of the Middle Way School and the people attached to that kind of vocabulary, what does that mean, essentially pure? It means that it is naturally devoid of any inherent existence from the very start. That's what we mean by essentially pure. Are you having a headache or something? Are you okay?
Yeah,
all right.
Fine.
All right, okay. All right. So that's the idea. So everything that appears, everything that occurs has this sort of a nature, this fundamental pure nature, and is like of this nature of spontaneity, of spontaneous things appearing out of it fundamentally. And when these manifestations or appearances arising from the fundamental mind are unimpeded, that means we've removed the obstructions and the obstacles, then the effulgence or the shine, light shining, what shines out from basic mind is something called compassion. Now, that relates to the question we were having the other day, I thought a little bit, right, about the non-dual awareness and compassion. Because why is it called compassion? Because its effect is the chinle, the compassionate activity, the enlightened activities, what a Buddha does, the compassionate activities of a Buddha. That's what's displayed. That's what when there's nothing clogging up or blocking up the free display of the fundamental Buddha mind, then that's how it shines as this compassionate activity. So then he gives a little example that's like the one I was trying to do with the marble tabletop and the oil. Well, actually, that one came from His Holiness too, but this is a similar one where he takes water instead. He said it's like this, that water might be extremely dirty, but its nature is to be completely clear as water. It's not its nature to be polluted by dirt. Similarly, no matter how much, anger and so forth are generated as the sport of this mind vajra, and no matter how powerful these afflictions are, the basic nature of the mind itself is unaffected by defilement and beginninglessly all good, samanta vajra gundasambho. So that's a little bit more on mind vajra. How does this work in the past? If you identify this basic mind and you ascertain that all the phenomena of cyclic existence in nirvana are its sport, then along the way you will, says His Holiness, be understanding that all pure and impure phenomena are only nominally existent. are only mere imputations by thought. So this is I didn't add any along the way. That's right in there, along the way. So I think you're getting the idea here. He's going to say, well, they're not directly talking about identifying the object of negation and refuting it, but that the process that they're going through is going to have the same effect in terms of eliminating the idea that something has an independent status of its own that's set it apart from mine. One understands that all appearing and occurring objects of knowledge are essenceless, and although phenomena have from the very start not been at all established on their own power, they appear to us as though they were set up from their own side, whereupon we then erroneously adhere to this seeming inherent existence. And you'll you'll see through all of that sham when you understand this basic mind. And you'll further understand that this misapprehension leads to our engagement in karmic actions, the cumulative predispositions, and so forth. So if you can cause all phenomena to appear to you as the sport of this basic mind, within not deviating from within that sphere of awareness that this is all the manifestation or appearance of this basic mind, then you won't come under the influence of conventional conceptions and distorted thoughts, because you'll be understanding everything as it is, that is the sport of the basic mind. So if you really do that, if you understand your own basic nature and continuously ascertain this meaning, that like everything's appearing as a manifestation of a basic mind within meditative equipoise, even though while going out and acting in the world at the same time, then that's what it means to be a Buddha. That's the idea. Okay. So that's the idea, the mind vajra. So he acknowledges then there really isn't much in here about the elimination of an object of negation. There isn't a direct, discussion of a practice of realizing phenomena as nominally designated. But I guess implicitly the Dalai Lama, understand such as a byproduct that arises right along with the understanding of all these phenomena as just being manifestations or the sport of the basic mind. Okay, so that's a part of it. He still hasn't fully dealt with the issue about the affirming negative and the non-affirming negative, though. In the Gelupa and other interpretations, when you're realizing emptiness, only emptiness appears at that time, not the existence of emptiness even, not the meaning of emptiness as dependent arising, but just the sheer absence of intrinsic nature with nothing else appearing in its place at that time. And so he says this is a fundamental tenet in all Madhyamaka systems, that emptiness is, as he understands it. And he points out how Bhavaviveka especially, but also Buddhakalika and Chandrakirti, are really emphatic on this point, and that's why these Gelugpa critics, are not comfortable with the Nyingma approach. Okay, so what is he going to say about this? How is there some way or point in this process of Dzogchen practice where you're not just recognizing all of these things as the sport of some more fundamental kind of consciousness, because that's all, either an affirmative phenomenon or at best an affirming negative. Even if you say, oh, I've eliminated the thought that these things exist from their own side, you're still at the same time having in place of that an appearance of these things as something else. Do you see what I'm saying? It's not a sheer lack or absence. Okay. So is there a place where there's a realization of emptiness in the sense of a non-affirming negative in the great perfection process? Well, he thinks that there is. And that's, part of trying to fix things here. He says, when you meditate on in the great perfection, when you meditate on the basic mind with clear light, one pointedly observing the factor of just the mind is just clear and knowing, this meditative mind does not have the aspect of realizing non-affirming negative. We have to admit that. You know, it's not the, you know, what they're describing as the culminating practice involves an affirming negative. Okay, but prior to this stage, when you're just, you know, before you get to that, a step before, they're doing a practice called breakthrough, where the great perfection practitioner, who hasn't gotten to this, you know, deeper practice, analyzes by observing where the mind arises, where it abides, and where it goes. I remember hearing Zolinas talk about this one, right? I don't remember him saying this, but just the day before he gave this talk, he was giving a much larger public talk, and he talked about this for a long time. He was like actually suggesting to the people that they try to think about it, you know. And what it amounts to, at least in him, what it amounts to in His Holiness' understanding, is an ultimate analysis. Instead of applying it to persons or tables or cups, you're going to make the mind as the target of ultimate analysis. And he did talk about that. I don't know if everybody remembers that, but who was there, but he talked about it quite a lot when he was doing at Lehigh, when he's doing the teachings on the great trees. When he got to the section on meditation, he went through different meditative objects. And when he got to the mind as a meditative object, he went off for a long time on all different kinds of ways to meditate on the mind. So, in the course of this practice, where you're doing this analyzing where the mind arises, where the mind abides, and where the mind goes, it is ascertained that the mind is devoid of the extremes of conceptual elaboration, and then he says, and this is the realization of its absence of inherent existence. So he's, you know, and that, of course, to say that being the mind's being devoid of conceptual elaboration is equivalent to its absence of inherent existence is not a total stretch. That kind of language is often used in my Indian Madhyamaka text to talk about what we mean by inherent existence, is thinking of it as this conceptual superimposition on things. But anyway, that's his interpretation of what's going on with that breakthrough practice. So then later on, after having done the breakthrough practice, then when you meditate on the basic mind or the clear light, then you understand this clear light, this basic mind, this mind vajra, as a mind that's free from arising, abiding, and going. That is, it's already been qualified with a non-affirming negative that you previously realized before you're doing that practice. Okay, so you could say it if you put it in His Holiness's way, you know, that they've flipped. You've sort of flipped around the order. You know that they're what this. He goes on to say, like, well. In my way, we're stuck on channel A, and then you go over to channel B and you realize emptiness. And then when you come back to channel B, all these forms appear again, but they appear under the guise of being intrinsically empty of any nature. And then we talk about them being shimmering or hazing or illusion-like. Mm-hmm. Illusion-like is the main thing they say. It's like, so people thought, really what we want to do to be enlightened is to be able to see the whole world as like an illusion. That was such an important idea that, you know, some people thought, well, we could just do some kind of practice to make it so that we see the world as like an illusion without realizing emptiness. And Tsongkhapa had like a big thing in that, you know, in the Great Treatise, and say, no, you don't get it, you know. It's like absurd that you can get yourself in a very strange state of consciousness where you feel that everything's shimmering, but that doesn't mean you're enlightened, you know. So you have to really understand what it means for things to be like an illusion, it has to be understanding emptiness, and at the same time, within that, having things appear, and then therefore seeing that these appearances are deceptive. You know that things are appearing as though they were there, but in fact that they don't have any substance. So what he says is that, like, this that's an affirming negative, right? It's like saying there's something appearing, but I'm understanding this in the context of like a sheer lack of inherent existence. He's saying, well, they're doing their negation, they're not affirming negative first, and then they're affirming negative afterwards. And when we, like, the Turgot, the breakthrough practice, and then the manifestation and the basic mind, and then we're doing it the other way around. Where first we think that you have to have the non first we think, well, it's the same order, isn't it? It's the same order. I didn't realize that. I was thinking the order was different. It's the same order. We're saying it's not that the order is different. It's that we're saying the culminating practice is the one where you go to channel B, and we're calling that the ultimate mind. And then the other one is like the aftermath realization. And they're flipping that and saying, well, the warm-up is when you're going over to channel A, and that gets you ready to see what things are really like when you come back to channel B. That's what it is.
It's interesting because in Three Principles of the Path, he says the culmination of the view is complete when you come out of your meditation and emptiness. And
not when you go in.
Yeah. It's when you come out. Interesting.
Exactly. Right. And why would he say that? Because he would say that because then you don't have the complete Bodhisattva practice, right? If you only go, well, it's like, you know, Buddha sat down underneath a tree and realized emptiness and thought, this will be very hard to explain. And then that was the last we heard. that wouldn't, you're right.
He's still there.
Yeah, because that was the best. Or the ox herding pictures, you know, it's like, just go up to number 8, everything turns into a big empty circle, and then end the story. Right. So, yeah, that's interesting. Let's see if I left anything out here in the last part. So, conclusion. I'm skipping some, but because, you know, he goes, there's more to it, but. Well, it's just, look, this part is interesting because we talk about we talked about these two types of meditation. Or I guess Venerable Chogyam might have talked about this. In Nyingma, there's no clear and detailed explanation of whether your realization is a combination of mind and empty, whether the combination of mind and emptiness is an affirming negative or a non-affirming negative. But a few Nyingma scholars have said that it is an affirming negative. Mostly they don't talk about it. So because of that, there's, you know, these Gelugpa partisans will say that there's no way that they could become enlightened. But then he says, well, the issue is really much more complex, as we've been describing. There could still be a realization of a non-affirming negative in the moment before. And so then he says, well, there's two types. There's meditation when you meditate on impermanence, or you meditate on emptiness, that kind of cultivation. And then there's meditation when you generate the subject into a different type of subject, in the case of like meditating on love, where meditating on love is not, let's analyze love and to see what its parts are, but it's like generating the mind in that aspect. So he says, when you meditate on this profound mind in Nyingma, which kind of meditation is it? It's meditation in the sense of generating, identifying this profound nature of the mind, and then sustaining this mind in meditation. That's the second type of meditation, he says. It's like meditation on love. So you've already, before you do that, ascertained the emptiness of the inherent existence of the mind through the practice of breakthrough, before you then go through this process of generating the basic mind. Okay? So the mind which then appears, the basic mind which appears when you do the Dzogchen practice, is should be understood as being qualified by an emptiness of inherent existence that has already been realized in the prior practice of analyzing how the mind arises and where it abides and where it goes. Okay. So his conclusion: it is thus apparent, I'm skipping some of course, that all factors involved in cultivating the view of emptiness as presented in the text that are common to Sutra and Mantra in the new translation schools are also contained in the process of great perfection meditation. And then there's quite a bit more at the end also, and he gives you a little bit of, besides, you know, going back and talking about this Nyingma Lama that inspired him, he also says, I had, even before I came upon this, I noticed in Tsongkhapa's explanation of the hidden meaning, the first 40 syllables of the introduction to the Guhya Samaja Tantra, a quote from Nagarjuna's Panchakrama, the five stages, in which Nagarjuna says, everything is like the meditative stabilization of illusion. And the relevance of that, I think, is clearer now, you know, is saying, like, everything is like the meditative stable, is saying, like, the final state of things, if you just take that quote, you know, as your final thing, the final state of things is not the non-affirming negative nitsul, you know, but mode of abiding that's realized in channel B. It's like you could say that Tsongkhapa in that one tantric quote, he seems to be saying, well, you really understand things are like when you see them as this illusory-like appearance. Well, you know, this empty appearance is not discussed in non-tantric Gilug sources or Shastra Sutra sources as this sport of emptiness or the sport of basic mind. But it is in, you know, the tantric sources, including ones that are part of the new translation school. You know, not just in Nyingma. So then he has a little bit here at the end that's worth. He talks for a while about some of the, you know, weird things that people do in Tantra, like hunting, and what one can make of that, and a little bit, and then at the end he comes. To talking sort of real little dig buried all the way here at the back of the book against his Gelugpa friends. With respect to identifying the clear light and the great perfection, how does that work? When, for instance, one hears a noise, between the time of hearing it and conceptualizing it as such and such, there is, briefly, a type of mind devoid of conceptuality, but is not like sleep and is not like meditative stabilization, in which the object, the sound in this case, appears as a reflection of the entity of the mere luminosity or knowing of the mind itself. That's apparently the practice. And he says, it is at such a point that the basic entity of the mind is identified in the Nyingma practice. Whereas we, trained in the philosophy of the new translation schools, frequently repeat to each other the definition of consciousness is that which is luminous in knowing, but have never even tried to identify it in experience. It is not sufficient merely to mouth definitions, divisions, and illustrations. Experience is necessary. And for this, the great perfection is extremely valuable. Okay. So, this is a pretty effective piece of work. And, you know, I'm sure not what a lot of the, you know, the species, well, you know, where I don't know, do they read it though, right? You know, does it get published in Tibetan? You think they read it?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Definitely did refer recently, you know, to actually one of my teachers sort of having finally gone to some Dzogchen teaching, saying to His Holiness, oh, that was very interesting. It was really helpful.
It's just like,
I've done it before.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I thought I was going to be corrupted, but actually it has had some benefit. Yeah. Well, there's so much anxiety about those kinds of boundaries and differences, and you can see that, you know, he's boldly going across them and not just like, you know, traipsing around, but like totally like digging into this stuff in a very deep way. And of course, he cites books, but you know, I think he's like invites, you know, teachers over, I don't know about now, but I know, and you know, over, he's taken teachings from Nyingma Lamas, and you know, that I, when I was able to see him briefly in 1985, my appointment was directly following that of a Nyingma guy who was coming out as I was going in. So I was like, oh, this is interesting, you know. It's like he's taking, studying this, not, you know, just talking about. So now that really helps a lot in terms of as far as it goes, which is quite a lot farther than it seems, you know, other people have that I've seen. But what you can, going back to the beginning, the way he fixes this up is to show that, although not so explicit and clear, really what Gelugpa considers essential to have happen is somehow happening in Nyingma. He doesn't fix it up by saying, well, Tsongkhapa was, you know, a little off and he failed to consider something, right? He doesn't smoosh the two together into some new system. What he tries to do is say, look, these are the things that, you know, fundamentally you have to have as part of the view, whether you're doing tantra or not, in order to overcome the root of cyclic existence, the realization that all phenomena, including whatever you're calling ultimate or highest, is devoid of any intrinsic nature. And then he uses that, although in a very subtle way, not being attached to particular words, but he sticks to that as his principle to judge, okay, what's really going on and is it, and why? Why would it work? How could it work from my Gelugpa point of view? So I think if someone thinks that he's abandoned the Gelugpa point of view because he says this, they haven't really read that closely. Because he doesn't abandon the Gelugpa point of view. He says that having this as my view, I'm able to recognize that this practice has great value and leads to enlightenment because using different language and different techniques, it's achieving what's at the heart of, you know, what's in our system as well. Okay. But what if you have a system that says, well, that's just simply not the case because not everything is empty of intrinsic existence. You know, you try to fix things up, His Holiness, by saying that, you know, we really believe that everything's empty of intrinsic existence, even though that wasn't really, we were mostly talking about basic mind and mind vajra and the sport of, you know, this fundamental mind. And you've interpreted all this in such a way to, you know, make it align with what you think that we ought to be saying in order for us to be okay. But that really wasn't what we meant. What we meant to say was that there's something fundamental, some kind of fundamental mind nature that is self-existent, is that other things, it's okay, can these conventional things to be empty of intrinsic nature, but what we've been trying to tell you is that there's one thing that isn't empty of an intrinsic existence, and that you guys are nihilists because you deprecate it by saying that it's empty of its own nature when that's exactly what it isn't in its basic character. And that's called Shendong. That's called Shendong. It's saying, like, the means emptiness of other, and saying that the ultimate is not self-empty, but just empty of being other things. It's a non-empty emptiness. Because I'm not making this up. That's what Sherrod Gelson's called, a non-empty emptiness. Because it's not self-empty. It's self-existent. And there are many people, not now, this idea was started, well, let's see. it was made clear and dawned into the world in an explicit form, you know, who knows where, that's like a two, if you say where it started, then it's like, oh, he made it up anew, but anyway, it dawned into the world, you know, from Dolpopa Sherab Kelsen, who was in the generation before Tsongpa, is born in 1292, and I don't know, I think he might have just overlapped a few years with Tsongpa before he died. And his you know, he had vast knowledge. He was raised in a Nyingma family, but he studied with everybody, and he had vast scriptural knowledge, and then, you know, deep practice and learning, especially in the Kali Chakra Tantra. And he came to this set of this doctrine called other emptiness, where, in, you know, it's true that, no, it's not just like let's space out and stop thinking kind of thing. Because we should analyze, we should use all the arguments of Nagarjuna, we should, you know, study tenets and study scriptures, and we do all that to eliminate the superimposition about conventional phenomena as having some self-existence. They're not intrinsically real. And when you, that is where the Brillo pad came in. When you scrub away with the analysis, so it's a very, it is a system that involves analysis, but the purpose of analysis is not to show that everything's empty of intrinsic nature. It's to show that all these things that we're attached to and clinging are empty of intrinsic nature, and to reveal the fundamental purity of this one thing, which is self-existent.
Is he really saying that other things are empty of inherent existence? I thought he was saying that that he defined self-empty as differently. And so that wound up meaning that things were totally non-existent.
This is a very difficult point. And I know enough to know that it's a difficult point because I've been reading Final Exposition. Jeffrey actually starts, if you read the Final Exposition of Wisdom by Jeffrey, you'll see that in the back part of it, he has this whole discussion about Dolbo's system and how it relates to Tsongkhapa's system. And it starts with exactly that issue. Does Dolbo think that conventional phenomena exist and are empty of intrinsic nature, and that's, or does he think that they don't exist at all and are merely posited by ignorance? And Jeffrey shows that there's conflicting evidence within Dolbo's work itself. And I mean, he seems to think that Dolbo was walking a fine line in this regard, that, you know, maybe he was one of these people who thought that, well, he seems to say, for example, that the conventional phenomena do not, and in any way, even conventionally, abide in the mode of existence. In other words, but that's no different from Prasangika saying, from the point of view of emptiness, things don't have any intrinsic nature, even conventionally, right? But some of the ways he says that could be interpreted as saying, well, everything's just imputed by ignorance and doesn't exist at all. So anyway, I don't know. I can't say for sure whether he thinks ordinary things are utterly non-existent, or ordinary things, let's say, are self-empty. What are they emptied of in this self-emptiness? Is a little, that probably is a matter on which different people who followed his system have different interpretations, and certainly could based on what he said. But clearly, all of these phenomena are self-empty in some sense, which is either that they're stripped of intrinsic nature in the Madhyamic analysis sense and use Nagarjuna, to show that these things are empty of intrinsic nature, as we would. But then there's this pristine wisdom, which is not subject to such deconstruction, but is like the basic purity of the mind, or the truth body, you could say, that's revealed. And this is not then the guy, this who started this, Sherup Gelsen, then lived at a monastery called Jomongnang, and so it became called the Jonangba system originally. But then as the Gelugpas became very powerful and then they were uncomfortable with this idea, there was an effort to stop the promulgation of this idea from this monastery. What I read is that they went there and shut down the place where they were like making the books that had this doctrine. But it didn't. It was, the cat was out of the bag by that time, and like there were people all over eastern Tibet and down to today, who don't necessarily call themselves Jonangbas, although there are still Jonangbas. But there's all people all over in Gagipa and Nyingma, who their way of understanding what their system means would not be fixed by what we read from His Holiness, because they hold that the Prasangika view is a nihilistic one that has to be superseded by the Shendong view. And this is the view of Andy Carr. I saw somebody that Andy Carr had a little article on Pramana that you left that out. It was very clever, right? He's really... He comes up with all kinds of like entertaining and clever examples, right? And this is from Andy Carr's book. When he comes, he goes through all the tenet systems, and then he gets up to Prasangika, and then after that he comes to the highest one, Shendong Madhyamaka, or sometimes called Maha Madhyamaka. And in a way, it's kind of like a combination of things from, you know, Yogacara with things from Madhyamaka. But it's not, it's more than that, because neither of those, as we understand it, is positing that there's some, you know, essentially real fundamental mind. But it is like that in some ways. He combines the idea of the three natures and so forth into his teachings about emptiness from Nagarjuna. So Jamgong Kongtrul, who's a great Kagyupa scholar, he takes as his, you know, official clear statement here, and you couldn't be any clearer. This system explains that sutras teaching that all phenomena have no inherent nature are not to be taken literally, and anyone who accepts such statements as literal is a propounder of nihilism. So this is, and then Carr goes on to say, this is a dead end spiritually. The Shandongas agree that genuine reality is something that's empty of conceptual fabrications. That's what we would call like being empty of inherent existence. But then they go on to assert that there is a genuine reality that is not empty of non-dual wisdom. And that turns out to mean that that is not empty. It's not, yeah.
I was reading in the break, Rish Hollis was talking about the good Shentong and the...
Oh, yeah, tell us about the good Shentong and the bad Shentong.
And the good Shentong, when they were saying that the mind was other empty... The other that it was empty of was adventitious defilements. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. In other words, the defilements were not the nature of the mind.
Right.
And so it was empty of them, and His Holiness says, well, that's true.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
And so he said that is the kind of Shentong that, for example, Dogo Kensei Rinpoche, you know, so says that that's
what we mean by Shentong.
That's the good Shentong.
Yeah.
Then the other Shentong is saying that on one hand it's nihilist, because it's saying that conventional truths are just posited by ignorance and they're empty of being themselves. Not that they're empty of true existence, they're empty of being themselves. So that amounts to saying that they're non-existent.
Right.
So in that way they're nihilistic, but they're absolutist in the sense that they say that there's a fully enlightened Buddha complete with the 32 signs and 80 marks and the full Buddha's mind
latent as our
already inside of us.
Right.
And that's already there. And
right. But the problem is I knew that His Holiness was teaching that there was a good Shendong and a bad Shendong. That, you know, having done this with Nyingma, he, you know, there's still the issue of what to do about Shendong, and that I heard that he said that there's a good Shendong and a bad Shendong, but I haven't heard the explanation of how he's drawing the line. But you can see that, you know, he's drawing the line in a way that's consistent with how he drew it here, is that we have to have some way, well, you can call it Shendong, but you have to have some way of saying that ultimately everything is empty. And that's exactly what many Shendongas explicitly don't say, and they very explicitly say the opposite of that in such a way that seems it will be very difficult to fix up. Because it's like they're just saying, well, you know, you're saying the opposite of what we think is true, and in fact what you're saying, we see it as a nihilistic extreme. We understand what you're saying, and it's, you know, and it's wrong. It's lower. That's the view. And so I think that's that's not such an easily solvable thing. People might just have to say, well, we can't always solve all religious problems by saying it's all different ways of saying the same thing. Maybe sometimes people are saying something different. Yeah. Yes?
How do things break down in the new transitions as far as the second turning of the wheel and the third turning of the wheel, and which one's interpretive and which one's definitive?
Okay, well, in Gelugpa, there we say that the second turning of the wheel is the definitive, and general. Well, you go by the particular passages. Does the passage point at the final nature of reality that's the end point of making philosophical determinations? But what that ends up meaning is, in general, that the second turning of the wheel is where this profound emptiness of all intrinsic nature is taught. And then the third turning of the wheel is what mostly is taken as definitive by Shenlongbas and Yogacaras, mostly. So as far as when you put it like, you know, in the New Translation School, then you have the problem that they're within Gagyupa, which is part of the New Translation Schools. There are Shenlongbas, they're good Shenlongbas, they're bad Shenlongbas, and they might not always have exactly the idea, the same idea about the hermeneutics with regard to the three turns of the wheel. But I will tell you that Andy Carr, who is, you know, clearly comes out as a Shenlongba and lists all the things as a follower of Trungpa Rinpoche, that he definitely thinks that the third turning of the wheel is a corrective to a kind of tactical nihilism. You just like there's a, you know, I say a tactical realism in the first turning of the wheel, that there's a tactical nihilism that the Buddha engages in the second turning of the wheel, and then everything balances out in the third turning of the wheel, and you get the actual, you know, real truth. That's the way they generally look at it.
Is that consistent with Trungpa's teaching?
I don't know. I assume so, because he's obviously totally reveres Trungpa. What I've read of Trungpa is not a great deal, but what I've read, it doesn't make anything clear about this one way or the other. I don't know what anybody else thinks.
No, I never looked at it from this perspective. You know,
yeah.
Kind of
yes.
So Shendong is, did you say, mostly part of the Kagyu school, or is it kind of its own?
It's not a school. It's a philosophical idea, you could say, or set of ideas that derives from Sherup Gyaltsen, Dobolba Sherup Gyaltsen, who started out as Enigma when he was young, but then in the end founded his own school called the Jonangbas. And sometimes His Holiness will say, like, you know, he'll usually list four orders of Tibetan Buddhism, but sometimes he'll say, and the Jonangbas, as like, you know, he's trying to include them, but then he doesn't always find a way to like say how they're saying the same thing. But he's like, he says, he'll say like, and then when we talk about self-empty, when we talk about emptiness, then it means like this for these, but then there's also this. So he'll include it as something, you know, a teaching that exists, but he won't say that it means the same thing as the other ones. So is it mostly Gagyupa? Well, originally it was its own sect, and apparently this sect still exists, but it's small. But then the idea that originated with this is influential on any, like, just like Vaibhashika or something, like anybody could adopt this view if we figure out, you know. And so within my understanding is that it's in Nyingma and Gagyupa where you have many Shenlongbas, and that the Shendong tradition is like very, very strong, like even though the Gelugpas were able to like tamp it down in central Tibet, and so, you know, it wasn't so big with, you know, Sakya, that in eastern Tibet where there it flourished and down to today, it's a predominant sort of Tibetan Buddhist view or practice. Yeah. Well, no, yeah, if they're Kagyupas, they do. But no, we'll hear, just to make it clear. When he lists Shendongba, he counts it like a tenet system. So he's a Kagyupa. He is in a Kagyupa lineage. But within Kagyupa, he's not going to say that the highest view is Prasangika of Chandragiri. He's going to say that that's the next, the highest view. The highest view is Shendongba. So that, do you see what I'm saying? So say Jonang, we'll count, try to distinguish Jonang and Shendong. Jonang, we're going to count as like another kind of Tibetan Buddhism, you know, right, a sect, and if we use that for Trilok or Dharma order, right? And then separate from that, you have a tenet system. Earlier, you know, I told the Kensuri Yeshi Tukten told us he could have all the different tenet systems and all the different Trilok. Well, now we have another tenet system, in effect. And Tsongkhapa is saying this is something that was just made up in Tibet. It has no legitimate basis in any Buddhist scripture. It's beyond the pale of, you know. And basically, people, Gelupa is thinking of this as not being Buddhism. And therefore, you know, not, you know, the general Buddhist tolerance for all different kinds of views that Dr. Buddha fortunately has a vast pharmacy, because we have all different kinds of problems, and you don't, you know, give the laxatives to the person with constipation, and there's certain persons you don't teach to go meditate in charnel grounds at certain times and so forth. So you have like different kinds of things for different kinds of people. And so we, almost all Buddhists have this attitude of everybody's differences are valuable because there's all different kinds of minds that all need all different kinds of help. And there's all, you know, there's some limits or exceptions to that. And in this case, you have a situation where one group really thinks that the other group has gone beyond the limits of what they can in any way count as Buddhism. And that's what sort of happened between the Gelugs and the Jonangbas. And so, you know, I guess that there's still some bad feeling.
About the Shambhala? Maybe he doesn't call it Buddhist, he just calls it Shambhala.
What?
Trungpa, when he's teaching it.
I have no idea.
You don't know about
that. I have no idea, yeah.
What is seen as the danger of Shambhala?
Well, one problem is this, is that in the Gelupa way of understanding it, is that in order to become free from cyclic existence, you have to realize the emptiness of intrinsic nature. And if you have one thing that's like accepted from that, first of all, you have a philosophical problem in terms of Nagarjuna's analysis of how that could be. It seems to be self-contradictory to all the reasons that are applied to everything else. And then you have the problem of like, how does that work? You know, does it not ramify out so that you have, if you have a realism about one thing, then how does that, you know, insofar as anything else exists at all, isn't that realism going to spread out into other things? Well, it doesn't in this case, because it seems like there's a tendency to say, well, no, absolute other things really don't exist at all. There's a mere seeming to exist about them. Although this, as I say, is like, but if you look at the very beginning of that thing that you're saying about how he starts at the very beginning with very first page of Jeffrey's discussion about that, is he has some quotes where he thinks it shows that, you know, that the Dolpa thinks that horses and cows exist. But anyway, so this is unclear whether he really thought that everything else was an existence. But if other things have existence, then how are they not going to, in terms of Mandalmika analysis, sort of like have this kind of reified essence as part of what they are, since it's ultimately, like in Vaibhashika, okay? If you start saying that like things are made out of real parts, then things are in some way have a real foundation, and then they become. So this is the way that Prasangika looks at it. Is unless you understood that everything is empty of intrinsic existence, you're never going to eliminate the subtle root of cyclic existence and become enlightened. And right?
Yeah, right. And they keep saying, you know, not an atom is truly existing.
Not an atom. And now they want to have like a lot more than an atom.
Right.
A very special super atom. And this is a big problem. Yeah.
So then ethical implications of that view?
Well, then it would be, like you were saying, if they say conventionalities are just posited from a viewpoint of ignorance and they don't exist, Right.
Well, but I didn't read you that part of this is already an issue a little bit in just with the Nyingma thing that okay, so before you even get to Shendong, just when it's all I didn't deal with the part about behavior. But, you know, it's only, okay, when you do this practice of manifesting the basic mind, then what happens, according to Nyingma, you know, great perfection teachings, is that you go into a mode, see, the basic mind has this characteristic of spontaneity. Just like because it's the Buddha mind, and it doesn't think about what to do or say, oh, that would be good or this would be good. So, When you see everything that's arising in your mind as part of the sport of this basic mind, then you go into this mode of spontaneous or effortless practice, where you don't. And as this is in His Holiness's Gelupa redescription of Nyingma, that you don't have to or need to think about what's right or wrong, and your behavior can be quite unconventional in the usual sort of tantric mahasiddha way. And it's not like, you know, your behavior is a sort of part of the sport or display of the fundamental basic mind. So that's all very well and good if all these people are really Buddhas. Do you see what I'm saying? But then that was sort of the whole problem in the first place, and why Nyingma was being deprecated was that some people probably weren't, and yet they felt that they were, their unconventional behavior violated various norms was actually not subject to ordinary moral standards because it was this effortless, spontaneous yogic display. I mean, that's real. I mean, I think that really happened quite a lot. Yeah, right. Right, okay.
It's still
having it.
It's still a thing that's going on.
Yeah.
So.
In our tradition and other traditions as well.
Yeah. So, I you know, people feeling that they've reached a level of enlightenment such that rules have, you know, they're. It's not that they spontaneously behave correctly. It's however they behave is correct because it's their behavior and they're enlightened. Yeah.
I mean, this is through all these scandals that happened in the early 90s. This is exactly what was at the bottom of it.
That's true.